You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we return to the paranormal, and we're off on a road trip around Illinois' most haunted locations outside of the major city of Chicago. Keeping me company on this paranormal pursuit are our good friends, director Joe Trury and Chad Lewis. Joe's latest documentary, Paranormal Prairie, takes us to some of the prairie state's less well-known supernatural hotspots. We head out to Williamsburg Hill, home to a spectre on the hunt for children to join in some paranormal pastimes. The whole area seems to be permeated with high strangeness in every aspect. We then head down to Greenwood Cemetery, home to ghostly brides and forgotten history, take a short trip to Alton and its haunted and infamous Mineral Springs Hotel. We touch on the Turning Angel statue, brave the infamous Seven Gates of Hell, before meeting the scariest ghost of them all, in my opinion, murderess Julia Markham, who inhabits an area known as the Death Curve, and her story, based in fact, is probably as scary as the paranormal legends it's created. Joe also informs us of Chad's insistence for him to visit as many cursed locations as possible, just to see how true these curses could be. But before that, don't forget you can support the show by visiting patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters to sign up for $4 a month for ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and much more. You can also click on the Patreon link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to my latest Patreon, Jeanette. Thank you and welcome. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit the website, mysteriesandmonsters.com, for any merchandise needs and up-to-date news. As always, a big thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So buckle up, sit back, and let's hit the road with Joe and Chad on the hunt across the paranormal prairie. On this week's show, we head out on the hunt for haunted locations across Illinois. In his new documentary, Paranormal Prairie, Joe Trury takes us on a hunt for some seriously ghoulish ghosts. Also joining us on this episode is our good friend and a man who even Wendigos are afraid of, Chad Lewis. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show. How are we both?
Doing great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, happy winter.
Yes, of varying degrees, it would seem, chaps, of varying degrees. Joe, looking at your new documentary, as I've mentioned to you both before we started doing this interview and obviously correspondence before Christmas, I love programs and documentaries like this because it takes me to places I would have never known about, really. And I think, looking at Illinois, I would imagine as a filmmaker, the biggest issue you probably have here is, where don't you go? Because there seems to be a real rich history of strange locations all across the state.
Yeah, for a fact. And it seems the more I delve into it, the more that I dig up, so to speak. And it's considered one of the older states, and yeah, we have a rich history of all kinds of things: pirates, Spanish explorers, French explorers, tons of cemeteries, tons of old buildings, just many different places to explore that have, you know, just regular history and haunted history as well.
Is it somewhere, Chad, that you've done some of your backroads lore investigating? Because obviously, it's not too far across from where you are, so I would imagine this state's ripe for your kind of love of the paranormal in all its forms.
I've done several books on Illinois monsters and hauntings and the like. And I think one thing that people who have never been to the state often mistakenly believe that it's Chicago, that that's Illinois, that it's all one big city, where I think Illinois, like a lot in the Midwest, has that uniqueness of, yes, it does have the big cities, but it also is very rural in places. And when you're in the southern end of the state, you're in the South. It feels like you're in the South. The accent's there, the people are there, the weather's there, the climate, it's all different. So I think that's what makes Illinois special, is it has this wide variety of not only peoples, but places as well.
Absolutely. And I think you're right there. Often you can find with certain states that there is this perception that it is the main city and everything else is secondary to it. And yet, when you look at Illinois, it's got some pretty large places there anyway, regardless of the size of Chicago. And I think, once again, it's one of those states that for a lot of people outside of the US, they know next to nothing about it. So documentaries like this, Joe, I would imagine, are more of a paranormal tourist guide as well, because it's refreshingly not focusing on anything to do with Chicago.
That's true. And I live several hours from Chicago. I live pretty much in the middle of the state. I don't like driving to Chicago. It's too big for me, to be honest with you. So it's really refreshing to go to all these smaller locations that are just tucked away and hidden that some people know about and a lot of people don't. And another thing, I would never have a reason to go to those places either, and unless I had or stumble across some evidence that there's something there. So it's pretty exciting to be able to visit these places I would otherwise never even go to.
Oh, very much so. And I think if you're going to do a paranormal invitation, this documentary is a perfect example of what to do. So when you were sort of pulling it together, Joe, did you have a hit list of locations that you wanted to visit before you started it? Or was it a case of you came up with the concept of wanting to show off the paranormal delights of lesser known places in Illinois and just sort of built it from that point? Did you kind of know where you wanted to go, or was it all completely fresh and you just kicked off and thought, right, where are the ghosts going to lead me?
You know, the first thing I did was it's the concept of I always like, you know, paranormal stories, spooky stories. But I didn't want to do something that was just like a generic legend, you know, like the old escaped convict with a hook for a hand. You know, I was trying to think, where can I go where I could, you know, something actually happened in that area? Because I think it's more fascinating if you could actually go to a place, not just have this vague concept of, you know, creatures in the forest or something like that, you know, or ghosts out in the middle of nowhere. So I just try to think of some of the places that were actual, you know, concrete areas you can go to. And I had a few in mind, like Greenwood Cemetery is, I've known about that for a couple decades. And the Turning Angel is something I've heard about for a couple decades. But then as the best place to do research is to look at the work that, you know, a lot of amazing authors have already researched, like Chad and Troy Taylor, Larry Wilson, who's also in the movie. People that write these books, they're more than just authors. I consider them historians because they really delve into these mysteries, the backstories behind them. So, you know, I had a lot of good research. Chad mentioned some of his books. Troy Taylor has a ton of books, you know, just different authors. There's just a wealth of information in those books to find. So I just did a little research in them, had some chats with Chad of some locations, you know. So that's basically how I figured out where to go to. And then there's always the Williamsburg Hill one was actually one of my coworkers who used to live in that area. And she told me to look into it. And that's how I discovered that one, found out there was a book about it as well.
Fantastic. I suppose for you, Chad, as well, when you're coming into a project like this, as Joe refers to, there's such a rich history all across the state. for you especially, I would imagine it was hard pressed for you to kind of pick your favorite. I mean, you do cover an incredibly dark and tragic story with a paranormal twist to it as well. So how is it for you sort of sifting through everything you knew about Illinois?
It's really difficult because you have to decide what you want to focus on, where if you want sensational stories that may or may not be true, there are tons of those. If you want ones that have a historical bent to them or a origin story, you have those. If you want major cities, like people love doing walking ghost tours of big cities and pub crawls. And I love that too, but I also really enjoy those rural desolate places where help is nowhere to be found. You're on your own. It's up to you to find the place, which is sometimes a challenge in itself. So I think putting something like this together, Joel had a difficult decision of what do you want to focus on? Do you want? And I think what I love about the movie when it came out, or the documentary, is that it's not a bunch of teenagers running around with equipment to detect ghosts, that where nothing ever happens. It's really focusing on the history and the mystery in it. For me, it was really a throwback to the old documentaries of the 1980s and 90s where they focused on the stories and the legend and the folklore rather than, you know, some character actor running around scared.
Very true. I think, I mean, the other thing that attracts me to documentaries like this is, as I'm sure I've mentioned in passing before, chaps, and I know I've mentioned it on the show, I grew up in an old vicarage as a child, which was haunted, which was straight across the road from our local graveyard. So I've always had a very comfortable relationship with graveyards. I find them deeply fascinating places, and whenever I go anywhere, I will often just have a little wander around the local graveyard just to drink in, as you say, some of the local history and the characters of places wherever I go. And some people might think that's odd, but as you referred to there, Joe, I think one of the strongest points of the film is also the fact that we are talking about historical aspects of it. We are talking about these towns' pasts and characters that have lived there and some of the stories. And as you mentioned about Greenwood, here's a cemetery that has a very strange history, as you mentioned in the section about it, because unusually for a state in the north, there are a lot of Civil War victims buried there from the Confederacy, which was quite unusual. But as the section explains, unfortunately and rather sadly, they simply just couldn't be bothered to take them anywhere, could they?
Right. And, you know, that's like an important feature that I was looking for these stories. Is there documentation of the stories behind them? I totally enjoy the historical aspects of graveyards, too. Ironically, I don't really like messing with the spirits and stuff. That scares me the most, to be honest with you. But for some reason, I'm drawn to the stories. I don't think it's weird to be attracted to graveyards. I don't understand the attraction myself, but I'm with you. Like, I like visiting them, especially in Illinois. Well, where I am, we have like Greenwood and Oak Ridge, where President Lincoln is buried.
Mm.
They're very park-like. They were actually designed to look like parks, so they have this certain quality to them. And Greenwood not only has like this park-like quality, but they're, you know, like you mentioned, the Confederate soldiers, it has the a Union soldier cemetery, and it has all these mausoleums, where in central Illinois, mausoleums aren't common at all. So that's like one of the first things you notice. You go in there and there's these, I think they're cool looking, you know, just intricate mausoleums at the entranceway, like a good dozen of them. So it like gives you this kind of a eerie vibe just by looking at it, you know, that, you know, kind of sucks you in there.
What's your feelings about visiting graveyards? Chad, are you a fan, or is it something you tend to avoid unless you're on the hunt for something?
People tend to forget that graveyards used to be a place to congregate, that families would have picnics there at the gravestone of their lost loved ones. And it was a family outing people would sleep in graveyards at times, just going out there. So it was, I think a lot of them, as Joel just alluded to, were designed to be used for more than just a burial ground that you visit once on the anniversary of your loved one's death, that they were meant to be a place for people to use. So I'm with you, Paul, that I love whenever I'm in a new town, I'll go explore the graveyard, just looking at some of the sayings on the graves and who's there and how they're positioned. It's a good way to get to know the town's history.
Mm, absolutely. I think you can learn a lot about a place, and often you can... I often find it really kind of jaw-dropping sometimes when I look at the dates on some graves. Obviously, it's not a competition here, gentlemen, so please don't take it in that manner. But obviously, I can wander around graveyards here, and there, you know, there are people buried from the 1600s here. There is a very famous village 20 miles away from where I live called Eam, which is notorious because it essentially quarantined itself during the Great Plague of 1665, and a large proportion of the villagers basically protected the outside world and just locked themselves away, and unfortunately a lot of them passed away of the plague. So you can visit that little village now and wander around their graveyard, and it's quite jaw-dropping when you're just wandering about and seeing just how many people passed away over an 18-month period. You know, entire families were taken, and some of the houses, you know, a lot of the original houses are still there, and they've got plaques on the door, and you can have a look and there'll be like 7, 8, 9, even 10 people, all from the same family, passed away within 2 to 3 months of each other. So I think one of the other hidden aspects of this is, as we say, is it gives you a real historical narrative of the town, of the city, of where it's come from and what's gone on there. And as you say about Greenwood, I think for a lot of people, they probably don't know anything about this history with the Confederacy and what went on there. And also when you're talking with John about that particular area, this whole flood that came and washed a lot of the bodies out, these are momentous incidents that have occurred that really are quite shocking when we look back at it. But I think unless you sort of get past that kind of scare factor of a graveyard and deal with it at the end of the day as an area to respect past loved ones and friends that we may have lost, these are areas that were designated to be visited regularly. And therefore, for a lot of people, they find a lot of peace when they go there.
Yeah, for sure. And that's kind of the difficult part about filming these for me, is you have to maintain a level of respect because, you know, these were people just like you and I that deserve respect, you know, that have passed away. And how do you balance that with trying to tell a good paranormal story, you know? So I kind of struggle with that a little bit because I don't want to, like, I don't know, profit from someone else's misfortunes, even though, you know, it happened a long time ago, but that doesn't make it any better. I try to be as respectful as possible, but still have a level of entertainment, so to speak.
Mm. Well, I think that's another strong point, as Chad mentioned earlier as well. The thing about this documentary is most of it's filmed in the day, which is unusual because usually... people today, oh, we're going to do a documentary about ghosts and haunted graveyards and strange locations. It's going to be done at night time, and people, as Chad was referring to, people are going to be running about going, ooh, oh, there's strange things happening over here and everything. And I think that's another refreshing aspect of it, Joe, is that a lot of the interviews and a lot of the footage on location is done in the daytime. You can clearly see these areas. And I think, as you mentioned there, that gives it a bit more respect that we don't have this kind of sensationalism about some of these stories, because I'm sure all of us can go through hundreds of haunted locations where there's ghostly brides wandering around, scaring children at night and everything, and, you know, terrifying strange sounds coming from mausoleums and crypt keepers and strange lanterns bobbing about at night. Whereas here, as you say, you've got several locations where you've spoken to the local expert about these particular places, and we've got some really interesting stories of a variety, but nothing too far out. There's nothing too cliche.
Right.
These are very interesting stories without that kind of woo factor that we often get when it comes to the supernatural.
Right. Why do you have to sensationalize it to make it more spooky? Because really, if you watch it and you listen to the stories, are can kind of be unnerving, you know, on their own. I mean, and if you go to the locations, you'll get the vibe from the location as well. So it's like, I don't think it's necessary to try to spook it up more than it is. I mean, I do have my eerie music in the background, but I try to keep that at a lower level, but, you know, to add to the atmosphere. But I mean, the story, I think because there's a lot of historical context to it, I think that makes it feel more realistic and plausible.
Hmm. Believe it or not, folklore, legends, and stories of the paranormal, they don't follow any time clock or calendar. They don't punch a time card. That I receive just as many reports from people who have experiences during the day as they do at night. And it's often from people who are not actively looking for it. They're just out doing their daily things and weird things happen. And I used to film a bunch of dares at places that I would do, and most of them were in the day. And without fail, all the comments would be, are you too afraid to do it at night? Why aren't you there at night? And I never reply, of course, but I always want to say, because you wouldn't see anything. Yeah. You know, I want to show you this haunted road or this forest or the legend about a creature running through this woods. And if I was here at night, you'd see about 2 inches of my green face in the night scan, you know. So I think because of so many media shows and that people get this idea that things only happen at night in the dark, and that's just not true.
Yeah, I have to say that has always been a bone of contention for me, gentlemen, that I don't understand. When did we decide that ghosts only occur at night? I know people say, oh, well, it's quieter at night. Well, I suppose it depends where you are, because if you're in a graveyard or a place such as that, it's usually pretty quiet all the time. And you're probably more likely, as you say, Jad, to spot something when you're not running about with night vision goggles on or special green lights everywhere. Trying to find things, and you're more likely to do yourself an injury and fall over a grave or a memento or something like that. So I've never understood how we've got to this point where you can only go hunting for ghosts at night.
Right. And another thing is, this is my first one where I'm using drone work. Mm. And I think it's important. I like showing the area so people can get a real, you know, feel for the vibe and kind of understand, you know, try to immerse themselves into the area themselves. How can you do that if the screen, you know, if it's nighttime? I want people to be able to see the area and kind of understand what's going on around there.
Absolutely. I think it was interesting as well. Williamsburg Hill, it sounds like what doesn't go on in this particular area. I mean, it seems to have everything. We've got alleged cryptid sightings, UFOs, strange lights. But I think, other than Chad's story that we'll get to later, this is probably the creepiest story, I think, that's featured in the documentary, because the one about the old woman asking kids to come and play with her children is very, very creepy. So what did you think when you heard that story the first time, Joe? Because for me, that's the first place I'd think, well, I know where not to bring any children if I have them with me.
That's pretty funny. I can't show everything in the documentary that's there, of course. And, you know, Larry Wilson is the researcher author that I interviewed there. And he's got a book called Strange Williamsburg Hill. And that was one my coworkers suggested looking into. And she suggested that like a couple of years ago. And I finally, you know, thinking about this film, I'm like, okay, I'm going to look into it. And it's kind of like it's located in like the classic, like if you're looking at a slasher movie, that's what it kind of feels like. You're driving out in the middle of nowhere, open field, and then you get to this area, you see this huge mound out in the middle of nowhere, and it's surrounded by forest, and then you have this kind of dirtish road that winds through the forest and gets to the top of the hill, and then you dead end into this cemetery. And it's like, okay, I could see why, you know, people are kind of creeped out by this spot. And then Larry was telling us a couple of his adventures there and some of the stories that are there. And yeah, there's a lot more stuff that, like I said, didn't make the film. The children, there's stories about children being heard underground, their voices, you know, stories of this strange apparition, couple strange apparitions that wander the roads that are seen inside there on multiple occasions. I think he told me this, it's in the book, but it's a really creepy story about, sounds like there's like a Bigfoot like creature that wanders around the cemetery in the forest there, hooded figures, which, you know, who knows what that is, you know what I mean? So it's like the classic area where you think something's going to happen and chances are something will happen. It definitely had like a, when you go into these places, sometimes your senses take over and you get a little bit too hyper or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, when I first went there, it creeped me out for sure.
Well, I love anywhere where it's introduced as an area of high strangeness, because as soon as you say those words, I'm in.
That's what I really was attracted to, it because, you know, it's not only just the paranormal, there's cryptids, there's UFO, and there's this big tower on top of the hill. It's like a radio tower or something. It makes me wonder if whatever it's emitting kind of messes with your mind or something.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, it's the mound itself is, so we used to have a, back in the ice age, there was like a mile tall wall of ice that came down through the Midwest. And that mound is evidence of where like part of it ended, you know, as it came down from the north, it would drag debris. So we have all kinds of mounds like that in central Illinois, and that's one of them. So there's a lot of limestone in there. And according to paranormal people, you know, limestone is a battery for paranormal activity for some reason, which is fascinating to me. I don't know. I wonder if that has something to do with emitting something that messes with your head, that distorts reality or something.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the story that Larry mentions about this old woman, and the thing about this is there are two occasions where somebody's reported this as well, chaps, which I find, it's one of those stories that you don't hear many similar ones, because there are often stories about people seeing ghostly brides wandering around graveyards, or, as I said, phantoms and lanterns and all kinds of things and strange occurrences going on. And occasionally you'll have haunted tombstones and things like that,
right,
and strange images. But this is a really odd story, because the fact that two different children have reported meeting some old woman, inviting them to come and play with their children, and they go, oh yeah, no problem. Where are they? And then this old woman says, underground. And you're like, what?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course, anything with children ups the creep factor, doesn't it, right? So Larry also has some like EVPs. I don't know, you know, I don't know what to really think about EVPs, but the ones he played for me, I was just like, oh wow. You know, I mean, if I heard anything like that, I'd definitely run out of there as fast as I could.
Whereas Chad, we probably passed Chad running in.
I'm convinced Chad is trying to get me in one of his books as one of his victims. He always suggests these places to go to, or tells me where to look. And I think he wants to see how far he can push me into the spiritual realm. And then maybe I'll end up in one of his stories.
Any comment, Mr. Lewis?
You have to create your own destiny, I guess. So if these ghosts aren't taking people out, if curses are slowing down a bit, I'll do what I can to heal them up a little bit. But Joe makes a great point that a lot of these stories, they're in these window areas. They're in these portals, if you will, these beacons of paranormal activity, that you may go there because of a ghost story, and you start talking to people and they'll say, oh yes. And then that weird object flying in the sky I spotted, or some odd creature out in the woods, that it's amazing that once you start digging for weirdness and folklore, and Kevin, one of my colleagues, Kevin Nelson, and I have talked about this quite a bit, that we've gone from asking people if they know of any ghost stories in the area or haunted stories to if they know any folklore or weird stories. Because if you ask people if they know of any hauntings, a lot of times they'll say no, and they may know of a Bigfoot, but they don't think you're interested in that. So expanding it to all these different phenomena, I think, really makes your net a lot wider.
Definitely. I think one of those things is, like you say, is asking people, what else have you experienced then? Because if you just focus on one particular phenomenon, a lot of stuff is going to fall down the wayside. And especially when you have a place that sounds as weird as Williamsburg, you know, as I jokingly refer to when we start talking about it, there doesn't seem to be much that doesn't happen here.
I like how Larry Wilson refers to it as a paranormal stew. I think that's an excellent term, an excellent, accurate term of what to expect.
I mean, one of the other places you take us on tour with, Joe, is Alton, which is a fairly well-known city in Illinois,
yeah,
primarily because it is one that seems to have really embraced its paranormal history and its reputation. This Mineral Springs Hotel sounds a very strange place, and there are several of these locations dotted around the U.S. that used to be former sanatoriums and places of recovery that people would go. And I think often we don't realize just how many people may have passed on in these areas, because a lot of people would come there to get over consumption, or, as Troy refers to when he's discussing this, you know, a lot of people would come there for health reasons, and it's this confluence of three rivers as well, which kind of gives it this kind of spa reputation. So it became a spa area for people to visit. So what was Alton like when you were there? I mean, this seems to be another place where you're spoilt for choice into exactly where you can find some ghosts.
Right. Alton is one of those places. It's not too far from where I live, an hour and a half or something like that drive. It's one of those places where, when I was younger, I knew about the reputation, but since I've been filming, it's just amazing the amount of history that's there. It's another place that has a Civil War history. It has the first penitentiary in Illinois, which was a Confederate penitentiary. So there's a lot of hauntings associated with the death and violence associated with that. There was a lot of Confederate soldiers died of smallpox on this place called Smallpox Island, right off and, you know, next to Alton. So there's a lot of stuff there. There's the Confederate cemetery that's there, which is really odd, just kind of like Greenwood. And it's marked graves, mass burial there as well, because that's how they were treated. And and if you go to the city's website, they actually proclaim themselves to be the most haunted town in Illinois. So they thoroughly embrace the paranormal aspects of it. When I first went there, that's like one of the few places where I kind of had some audio experiences in Alton, in that cemetery, actually. And now I'm a little bit more used to it. You know, when you're filming, you're kind of in the moment and you're more worried about trying to get things in focus and lighting and things like that, getting your audio correct. So it's hard to concentrate or think about being scared or anything like that. But it's a very historical place, which is, that's what really attracts me to it. And Troy Taylor's the expert there. That, and the Mineral Springs is probably his favorite haunt, I would say, in Alton, probably one of his favorite anywhere. But it's a really unique building, and it's really odd when you're at a place like that, thinking about all the people that have been there and suffered there, perhaps, or, you know, died there or whatever. It's just a really odd feeling.
I was going to ask you about this as well, Joe, as you touched on there. When you're sort of editing this and when you're filming, as you mentioned there, you're in the zone, as it were. You know, you're just bothered about, is the camera giving me the right shot? Can I hear the audio? Does everything look all right? Can I hear what we're recording? Does it make sense? So when you kind of sit down in the studio afterwards, are you kind of a little full of trepidation, more so now, because as as you've mentioned there, you've come across a few things when you've been pulling it together. And I mean, is there anything that particularly stands out that kind of raised the hairs on the back of your neck at any point?
Not necessarily when I'm editing, that's for sure. When I was in the cemetery there, this was a couple of years back, and I had some audio equipment on. I heard some really strange noises that I couldn't explain, but I mean, it's sensitive equipment, so who knows where it was coming from, but that like made me get out of there pretty quick. I don't really have a ton of like weird stuff happening when filming, probably because I'm in the zone or whatever. I get more nervous from some of the locals that are there than from anything in the spirit world or whatever. But and my other cameraman, Clayton, we joke about this often, about synchronicities. He doesn't believe in any of this stuff. I do. So I always have weird synchronicities when I'm filming. To me, they're weird. And for instance, I was going to do a story on the turning angel that's in the documentary, and I was trying to think of a local that I could have to interview on it, you know, a researcher. And I thought of a friend of mine that I went to high school with. His daughter does a lot of paranormal work. So I messaged her through Facebook, and she immediately responded. She, unknown to me, she was actually there at the cemetery at the Turning Angel exploring it when I messaged her. It's just like, it's like weird stuff like that, you know. That stuff creeps me out more than anything, I think.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think, Chad? Because obviously the Turning Angel is one of those aspects that we have a lot of these across the states, where these statues are created as a monument to the person that's passed away. And yet it seems that there are quite a few that seem to have developed a really negative reputation, and the Turning Angel seems to be yet another one of these.
A lot of the statuary throughout the U.S. was meant to symbolize, you know, everlasting love, remembrance of the people. It was thought to be in a positive manner, not only because they were extremely expensive to have that over your gravestone, but also it was meant to serve as a reminder for generations to come of your existence or your family love, whatever it may be. So the idea that a lot of them now are involved in these scary stories of most of them coming to life, and much like other dares, it's always bad. It's never anything good that if you touch this statue or kiss in front of the angel, you're going to win the lottery or find true love. You know, it's always mishap, misfortune, and death that's going to befall you if you do these things. So the negativity around these statues has really become 180 degrees from their main function.
Yeah, it is surprising. And I don't understand why they've sort of gained this dark reputation, because as you say, these are supposed to be symbols of people's love for the person that's buried beneath them. A celebration of their life and their memory. And yet most of them, as you say, I mean, there are several notable ones. There's a I'm trying to think of the, what's the one where apparently if you touched it, you die, which is one of those where you think, well, if everybody who's touched it's died, how do we know it's dangerous? It's one of those.
Yeah. Who survives to tell about that?
there's several. There's actually, Chad sent me to a witch's grave where if you touch the tree and don't get out in time, you die. He was trying to see if I'd touch it.
There's a theme developing here, Joe.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is when Joe was talking about Alton, I've often thought that there are many places around the world, many cities and towns and such, that you could plop down and do a life's worth of research on that one specific town. And what's great is there's nobody that knows more about Alton history and legends than Troy Taylor in the documentary. And that's evidenced by how, you know, good he is on the documentary. But I've often believed there are so many of these places, known and unknown, where you could just, you know, hunker down and spend your whole career looking at oddities throughout one small place.
Yeah, it is. I think this is the other aspect of this, is that for a lot of these places, it's the ghosts that bring people to them. Because, you know, as we've mentioned, a lot of this is wrapped up in an area's history. And I think often we forget, and, you know, I've spoken with Chad before and yourself when we've talked about Big Muddy and the Van Meter. These are places and incidents that have occurred in towns that if it wasn't for this monster or these ghosts, nobody would have any heard of these places. And I don't mean that disrespectfully. You know, there are hundreds of towns here in the UK where it's only a famous incident that's occurred there that most people will know it. I mean, as we're talking about this, there's a cemetery here in the UK called Highgate Cemetery, which is in North London, which is synonymous primarily because, yes, there are a few famous people buried there, George Eliot and obviously Karl Marx. However, it's more famous for the fact that at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 1970s, there was supposed to be a vampire running about in there, and mobs of people were turning up. You'd got wizards throwing magic spells around, and corpses were being dragged out of tombs and decapitated and all sorts. So if it wasn't for that, I don't think many people would even have heard of Highgate Cemetery. And yet, because of all this craziness that happened at that period, that's why people know where Highgate Cemetery in London is, because there are several notable cemeteries in London, but Highgate seems to have this reputation as being the most paranormal, primarily because of all this vampire craze that went on at that period.
Although I totally agree with you that that's absolutely true. I also think that, I also look for things that are a little bit less known, because it also brings a little bit more authenticity into it. Like, I've been to quite a few places throughout Illinois where it's very historical and they have these legends and folklore of the area that no one knows about, because the residents themselves know about it, but they just see it as part of their territory, part of their life. They don't really go out and try to exploit it. Not that other towns, you know, welcome to tourism. That's fine. I don't think that's bad or anything. I'm just saying I'm doing some investigations now where it's very, very historical, but they don't see it that way. They just think like, well, this is just part of our existence. This is everybody. This isn't important. I think it's important to tell these stories, you know? So it's kind of fascinating to find these places that have these legends that I think are great, and then the locals just see it as a daily part of their life.
Mm. I suppose, Chad, this is something that you specialize in, these type of towns where everybody who lives there knows about the legend or the incident or whatever, but they don't shout about it off the rooftops. And I would imagine, like Joe says, that's addictive for a person such as yourself, because these are unknown stories outside of a certain area. So for a lot of them, there are some incredible stories that may never have seen the light of day if it wasn't for investigators such as yourself and filmmakers like Joe actually taking the time to go out there and show everybody else what on earth has happened in these places.
I'm very interested in how some legends get so much publicity and people know of them and want to travel to them. You know, they get thrown up on the Mount Rushmore of paranormal activity. Mm. And then there are these others that I think are much cooler. They're scarier. They're more based in reality that people never hear of. They're not interested in it at all. But what I found over the last couple decades is the rise of paranormal tourism as well. One of my favorite hotels is in Minnesota, and I won't say its name because I love it. And I go there all the time, and I asked the owner, I said, how much business of yours do you think is from people coming here because they know that the place is thought to be haunted? You know, how many people are actively coming here because of the legend? And the owner told me, she said, about 80%. So you can imagine the place would have folded if it didn't embrace these legends. But yeah, I'm always curious as to the PR behind some of these legends and how some become known and others just are forgotten.
Yeah, there never seems to be any rhyme or reason, because often these places that don't have a reputation, in my opinion anyway, gentlemen, a lot of them seem to have a lot more going on than some of these more famous places and locations.
I think you need a cheerleader of sorts in the community, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce, the local folklorist, the history class at high school, someone to popularize it, because these things don't do it on their own.
Hmm.
That you need somebody to push that forward. And it helps when people like Joe cover it, or Hollywood covers it, or the media covers it. That helps quite a bit. But even though they might not be known in a greater region or area, many of these legends are known within that community. They're almost a rite of passage for teenagers to pass it down to the next generation, and then they'll go out there to experience it. So they're well known, just in a smaller circle than a lot of these legends.
When you were doing this as well, I mean, does Illinois have a history of haunted roads? Because I know as we lead towards the conclusion of the documentary, you sort of touch on these places. And obviously where I live, it's notable for a couple, and the UK has a couple of very famous alleged haunted stretches of road. Once again, one of them, most of the incidents have happened in the day. And yet, whenever they talk about it, they're always there at night. When nobody's, apart from the original incidents, nobody's ever reported anything happening at night, which I find peculiar that, you know, 95% of witnesses have had an incident during the day. So I would imagine Illinois having some extremely long stretches of road in quite remote locations is prime for some of those stories as well.
You know, I've been here my whole life, and the Collinsville Seven Gates of Hell is really the only stretch of road, haunted road, that I've ever been aware of. So that's why it's fascinating to read this stuff. And, you know, like Chad, when Chad or other authors research these type of stories, that's what kind of pulled me into that kind of concept. It's like, you're not just going to a place, you are driving on the place. So it's kind of like you're trapped in your own vehicle when you're on a haunted road. But yeah, I don't, other than maybe the Great River Route, where on the west side, you know, where Alton is, because there's always a lot of activity on border areas and rivers. There might be some more stories down there. And Collinsville is kind of that way, but not quite on the edge. But yeah, other than that, I've never really heard of anything until, you know, Chad suggested a Death Curve story.
Yeah. Well, what a way to wrap the film up, because you warm us up with the Seven Gates of Hell, which is a very strange, I mean, it's a strange run anyway, when you've got this stretch of road with all these little bridges over it, which is, it's a very peculiar landmark, if nothing else.
Yeah, you know, and it, what's really odd about it, so these, the it's an under, there are seven underpasses, and they're small because they were built such a long time ago, the vehicles were smaller, and I imagine maybe there's still horse and buggy at the time too. But it's the graffiti is what is unnerving. It's like just layers and layers and layers of graffiti, which is testament to how long the locals have been going out. As Chad says, the rite of passage, that's what, you know, these kids go to these alleged haunted locations, and they just spray paint all over these bridges. And I thought to myself, I wonder why the local police don't do anything about it, but they probably just got tired of policing there, you know, and because the road's out in the middle of nowhere, a lot of it. Mm. And it's just crazy seeing just this weird graffiti that, you know, it's probably an inch thick at this point on the road, on the side of the, you know, on the bridges, on the road, everywhere. It's an odd sight for sure.
Yeah, it certainly seems, I mean, it's one of those as well. You kind of can't place it when this kind of reputation starts with something like this, Joe, because obviously, as you refer to, people have been going there for decades and graffitiing it and leaving messages of a variety of standards, shall we say?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So clearly, this reputation is well established in that area, and it goes back to sort of the 50s, 60s, whatever. We can't really put a... And I find things like that really interesting, because it's when did it start? Why did it start? How did it start? Because it's one of those where some places there is an incident or a legend that springs up due to a well-known person passing away or a tragic incident. Whereas here, it just seems to have developed this whole reputation as being a cursed area of road.
Right. And that kind of like takes me back to what I was saying about authors, and Chad's like excellent at, with finding the root of the legend, which I have absolutely no idea how he finds out some of this information. Like, I wouldn't know where to begin to look. And like, if you read his books, they go into a lot more detail than I can go into in the documentary, of course, but having that historical reference, like the root of the legend, that really brings it to life to me, because it's like, okay, there is something based in truth here. Is there really activity? I don't know, but at least there's a foundation for the story behind the story, so to speak. And I find that super, super fascinating.
I mean, Chad, when you're looking at places like this, as Joe mentions there, do you have a specific criteria that you think, right, how can I unpick this legend? Where do you sort of start? Or do you, you know, which may seem rather obvious, do you start from where we are and work your way backwards? Or do you attack different legends in different ways, perhaps?
It certainly varies on the legend. I think any researcher today builds on research done in previous generations by people, whether they were researching the paranormal aspect of it or the historical aspect or maybe the architecture of some place, that a lot of stuff has been done. But finding the true origin of these legends is very difficult. Many of them don't have one. As you said, Paul, when did they even start? Was it the 50s, the 40s? And you talk to, luckily you can talk to some old timers and they'll put it back to when they remember it, at least. So you can at least say it goes back to that decade or that year. It probably even predates that by many times. And so it's very difficult. Now, oftentimes you'll get lucky and find a original story that at least the legend is based on. It may not be the true, unexaggerated version, but it's at least that core principle that the legend was based on.
Mm. Well, speaking of that, and I know we've given you a warm-up in regards to this particular aspect of Joe's film, Chad, this whole death curve story is awful. Basically, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful sense to any part of it. It's one of those aspects that there is a weird amount of similar stories like this that I've come across with my interest in crime and history and things like that, that there does seem to be some very strange amounts of cases like this across the US where people and families have all died horrifically with axes, and it's very strange. This one in particular, Chad, as you cover in the film, is heartbreaking, really, and it makes no sense. So for anybody who's unaware of the tragic story of Julia Markham and what happened, could you educate us on this tragedy?
Well, I first started receiving reports from people when I was speaking throughout Illinois, and people would say, have you ever been to Death Curve? There's a woman carrying an axe that will, a spirit of a woman that will chase you off the road and you'll crash your car and die. And I said, no, I never had heard of it at that time. So digging through the story, you're really right, Paul, that it became one of the most tragic stories I've ever run across, where I did a book on the most gruesome hauntings of the Midwest. And for the year or so I was writing it, I had the worst nightmares I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
It was really where I'd have to fire up a Hallmark Christmas movie to cleanse my palate.
Yeah.
And so the story of Mrs. Markham is one of tragedy. In 1905, she really snapped and went psychotic, lost her mind, and sent her two oldest children out to gather wood and water for the day. And when they were gone, she invited one by one her five youngest children into the home, where she took an axe and ended their lives. And then when the two older children came back, they were treated to the same behavior. And then in a matter of a moment, she snapped out of this spell she was in, if you will, and realized all seven of her children were dead. So she tried to slit her own throat and join them in death, but it must have been a dull knife or something it didn't take. So she gathered what was left of her children up and poured coal oil all over them and lit the bodies and herself on fire. And neighbors caught wind of this fire, literally, and ran over in time to see the bodies in the house and Mrs. Markham running out of the house like some charred Freddy Krueger character. And she collapsed on the front lawn. And when the doctor showed up and told her she was not going to survive, she finally admitted that she had murdered all of her children. Prior to that, she told people it was a door-to-door salesman that was responsible. And now it makes sense that if people are seeing a woman carrying a bloody axe on the middle of the road, well, at least now you have some origin point. And I love, Paul, that you brought up the idea of using an axe, because remember, firearms were available at that time. Mm-hmm. Every farm would have had a shotgun or a rifle or something, but yet these people were drawn to that much more personal, much closer axe, which for a lot of us, if we were ever forced to do something like that, I think a lot of us would pick a firearm.
Mm.
You're not getting your hands dirty, pardon the expression. So that's the story of this horrible woman completely decimating her entire family. And her spirit is said to wander that place, you know, perhaps looking for new victims.
I mean, there are a couple of really sad aspects to this as well. One is this letter that's found where she claimed that she was doing this as some kind of spiritual message, Chad, that she was wanting to gain access to heaven and be in the arms of Jesus by doing this, which was this, I think, was that discovered after she'd actually done the murders.
She had put it in the, yes, a terrible letter saying exactly what you said, that not only was she going to be with her kids in heaven, but she then invited the husband to join them. And she premeditated this because she put the letter out before she committed the heinous acts. So she had thought about it. She had put the letter out so it would be discovered after the fact. And when her husband did come home, in many newspaper accounts, they wrongly put that he had committed suicide because of the sorrow that he experienced, the loss of his entire family. But he actually did survive, moved out of the area, as you would expect, and spent his life in Illinois, ended up marrying later in life again. But the idea that she would do this to, again, the people she was entrusted to care for, I think for a lot of us, that's the hardest aspect, that as a child, the person that's most responsible for your safety is the one you have to fear the most.
Mm. And I think the other tragic aspect of this is, and I think you mentioned it as well, Chad, weren't they all buried together as well because they simply couldn't afford separate graves, despite the fact that she'd murdered her entire family?
The newspaper said they scooped up, and not to be blunt about this, but they scooped up what was left of the remains of the children and dumped them into an unmarked grave at the cemetery. And because of family finances, all they could do was to bury her next to them in an unmarked grave. So now not only did they suffer this ill fate in life, they're now suffering in death, being buried right next to their murderer.
Hmm. Unbelievable. So when did this reputation of this spirit or this axe-wielding ghost start appearing, Chad? Were you able to kind of, as we've mentioned there, look at when this legend or this story began to sort of seep out into the local community? Because I think the other interesting aspect of this is obviously this happened at the turn of the 20th century. So, you know, as we jokingly mentioned a couple of times, a lot of people in those days would be using horse and buggies or just horses. So is it one of those stories that's developed as the spread of the motor car came into fashion, or was it something that kind of just started after these tragic events?
I was able to trace it back to at least the 1970s. In my mind, it probably started a couple days after the event took place.
Hmm.
Not necessarily the idea of driving down the road and being run off the road by this deranged lunatic, but obviously the idea that this was a cursed place. it probably would have been talked about throughout the community the day after the news broke.
Hmm.
That's the way these work. But over the years, they just progressed a bit and always have changed. And I think we can't underestimate the importance of vehicles in folklore. For a lot of the people that experience these things, the vehicle is their first sense of freedom. That outside of their bicycle, the vehicle is the first thing that allows them to be on their own outside of their parents. You know, they can't get an apartment yet. They can't rent a hotel room. They don't have a house. You know, so the car, the vehicle is all important to them.
Mm.
So I'm always fascinated by how these things correlate with the legends themselves. And it's a big part of Death Curve, but I firmly believe that the legend of Death Curve or Julia Markham haunting the place or the place being cursed with spilled blood was predated the vehicles being there. You know, again, 1905, there would have been some vehicles roaming around, but I think the legend of it being cursed came long before the idea of your vehicle being targeted.
Yeah. So, without sounding churlish, Chad, which came first then? Because obviously I know you also mentioned the fact that people have said that if you park your car there and go walking into the farm, a ghostly farm appears, which is a very interesting aspect of this one as well. So did that sort of start when these stories of Julia's ghost trying to run people off the road appear, or is it something that kind of popped up further down the line, as it were?
Great question. I simply don't know. I don't know. That's a great question of, you know, which one came first. You know, does one influence the other one? Joe, do you have any ideas on this?
No, but I kind of find that fascinating that this event has like spread out to, you know, the haunted farm, the figure on the road, lights on the road, and then there's children seen in the cemetery, you know. So you have like multiple events, multiple hauntings based off of one event.
Mm.
And yeah, it's I haven't really heard of any other thing personally quite like that has sparked so many supernatural tales from it.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, it is a tragic story regardless. And once again, as I've said, Joe, one of the strengths of this documentary is the fact that we do have some real historical narratives here.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is definitely one of those ones that kind of tugs at your emotions, right? Where just thinking about of any of the stories, definitely the most tragic for sure.
Mm.
And it kind of hits home, you know.
Is there anywhere in Illinois that you were wanting to get to that you were unable to get to, Joe? Or do you have plans to kind of do a sequel to this? Because I absolutely loved it. And obviously, as we've discussed, there are plenty of locations in Illinois where there are many a spirit and ghost hiding around a corner or up a tree even. So is there anywhere that you really wanted to get to or yourself, Chad, that you were unable to sort of commit to for this documentary?
I'm still finding places. There's plenty of places out there. I'm actually doing one now, another Southern Illinois story about it's a area of high strangeness. So I'm working on that now, and it's very historical as well. So Paranormal Prairie too, you never know. I mean, there's plenty of stories out there. The more I explore, the more stories seem to pop up. You know, there's plenty of information in these books, that's for sure. I like the rural locations though. I like those a lot better than a big city location. There's just something more unnerving about being out in the middle of nowhere and seeing where these legends are and seeing where these events have taken place.
What about yourself, Chad?
I think Joe could do 20 sequels and never run out of stories. And what I love about the documentary as well is that although we cover and Joe covers more, a lot of places in the state, there's also a lot of general folklore sprinkled in. So that when we're talking about Death Curve, we're talking about why rural places seem to be more attractive to people that want to go to these places. Things you just don't get in a lot of the documentaries. As I mentioned earlier, when people are worried about gadgets and, and other things where you kind of forget that there's a general overall umbrella that people are interested in of they might not have thought of. Like when you asked me which came first, the burned down house reappearing or the road, is that a lot of times this is missing from documentaries. So there's a lot of that sprinkled in the documentary as well, where you can really learn about general folklore.
Well, it's fantastic, Joe, and I commend you on pulling this together and bringing it for us. So for anybody who's not seen it, where can they watch it and enjoy it as we have?
At the moment, it's available on Tubi TV, and Tubi is free. You don't even have to sign up or sign in. It's Tubi is ad-based, so there are some ads throughout it. It's not a large amount of ads, but once it's on Tubi for a while, I have it through a distributor, so it will be going on a lot of other smaller streaming services, most of which are free. So the main page you can see information for is on Facebook. You just look up Paranormal Prairie, and there's information there. I do have DVDs. I don't have a whole lot of luck selling DVDs. A lot of people like to stream, but they are available. If you're overseas, I can ship a DVD for you. I'll give you a good deal on it as long as you're willing to pay for the shipping. So just want people to be able to see it. So, hey, I'm all for it.
So as you touched on there, is that your next project that you're currently working on about this other area of high strangeness then, Joe? Where else have you got in the fire, my friend?
Yeah, that's it. It's called Grand Tower UFO. It's Grand Tower is a small river community, another border area. I think Kevin Nelson talks a little bit about it in the Big Muddy book. It's a really strange, crazy place, honestly. I mean, typical river town with a lot of super rich history. Again, the locals there don't even bat an eye that, you know, they had the Spanish were there and they had river pirates there. The main story takes place in 73 when we had big UFO flaps here in the Midwest. So that's one of the legends there. I've been talking to people who have recent sightings. I have a little bit of footage, some crazy footage of some unidentified objects, you know, and more witnesses to talk to. But yeah, it's UFOs, monsters, paranormal activity. It's got it all.
Fantastic. Oh, wow. I'm looking forward to that based on your previous work,
Thank
Joe.
You.
Brilliant. Chad, what about yourself? What are you hunting down and trying to encourage Joe to put his life at risk for?
Here's what I have coming up, Paul. I was sitting around after the Van Meter Visitor Festival with all the speakers in our hotel parking lot, just enjoying the night. And we're all talking about podcasts that are worth doing and that we love. And I brought up your name and everybody was like, yep, yep, obviously, obviously. And then all of a sudden, David Weatherly says, Chad, did you forget? I'm the one who recommended Paul's podcast to you. I'd forgotten it completely. But my point here is that when all of us researchers were sitting around talking about a podcast that we love and we love doing, yours was number one on the list. So there you go. That's what I've been doing.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. Yeah, I remember David introduced us after I chatted to him a couple of times when you just released the Wendigo book. And that was the first time we chatted, which is a couple of years ago now, Chad, but that's very kind of you. That's lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, Paul, along those lines, you know, for an independent, small little independent filmmaker like myself, I'm extremely grateful that you have your podcast. You allow me to be on here and promote my work, and love telling stories and talking stories with you. I really appreciate what you do.
Oh, well, thank you both. You're very kind. I mean, David surprised me because he gave me an acknowledgement in his last book, Chad. So which he didn't tell me at all. I interviewed him in November and he was telling me about his new book coming out and he never mentioned it. And I just finished reading it the other day as I was recovering from from the plague, and there I was, and I was like, oh, that was very sweet. So that's very humbling for you both. Thank you. And like I say, you know, you're both extremely talented creators in your own fields. Joe, you know, I loved your previous documentary, Big Muddy. This one's another one, as I said, that I love things
Thank
like
you.
This that just take me to places I wouldn't know much about. And Chad's obviously written some fabulous books and been very generous with his time and his Christmas cards that he sends me now. So, Thank you both as well for fitting me into your hectic schedules, gentlemen.
I'm going to do some research and send you on some death-defying places over there as well, Paul, so you can join Joe in your hunt for the end.
You have to make sure to film it, though, so Chad has something to go off of, you know.
Yeah, I need to exploit it, so please film it, record it, whatever you can.
No, well, I spent last Saturday at a haunted castle, but so far I've not seen anything up in any of my photos, but you never know. I'm going to another one at the week, and that's how I'm dealing with our post-lockdown. I'm trying to get to as many haunted locations in the day as possible, so you never know. I'll keep my camera with me. So, as always, chaps, once again, Joe, where can everybody follow and find out about Paranormal Prairie?
Facebook.com/Paranormal Prairie is and Tubi TV.
Brilliant. And Chad, where can everybody keep up to date with you and your excellent work and get hold of any copies of your books about some of these strange legends in Illinois, my friend?
You can find me trolling Joe on his Facebook page, Joe Turi.
Fabulous. Well, gentlemen, as always, it's a pleasure. Thank you for your time, your company, and your creations. It's been a real pleasure as always, and hopefully we shall speak to you soon.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.